What's up? Welcome back to the Lyricast Snippet. Today we're talking about the looming refresh of Lyricast.com. At the time of this recording, like 5 minutes ago, I completed my final task. So let me take a look. Redesign tasks and wonder list, 196 completed, and the only two things remaining are related to deployment. So I'm now at the point where I've gone over it as many times as I can. At this point, I just have to push it up. And honestly, I have no doubt that people are going to find things that I missed. It's just the way it goes. You know, it's sad, but at the same time, that's kind of the beauty of this semi-crowdsourcing. When you have thousands of people accessing any given page, they're going to be able to spot things that you miss when you're going over it time and time again, and your eyes start to blur. And your ability to spot things, I don't know why, but your ability just kind of goes. Like today, I went to lunch at Penn Station, and I'm working on my laptop, and I realized that this one image, the entire time I'd been working there, was like grossly too wide, to the point that it had become a little blurry. I say grossly, not grossly too wide. It was enough that obviously I could miss it. But once I realized that it was too big, it was perfectly clear. Or even little things like, imagine you have like a nav bar and each item, each link has like a border, right? But then your selected link has a different background color. Well, if you don't change that border right color to now match something that complements your selected color, if that makes sense, yeah, you can end up in a thing where you have like a green background with a gray border right, and you get kind of a blurry effect. Because what you really want there is maybe a slightly darker shade of green as the border. Those are the little things that obviously dedicated designers can see from a mile away. But for me, those are the things that I tend to miss. So I've been doing my best with my limited skills to get this thing ready. And you know what? I've been working on it since about mid-August. And I've come to the conclusion it's as good as I can do right now. Clearly, I'm going to continue working on it. But if you're not careful, you end up in a situation where you never release. We talk about that a lot. And this is clearly true for a lot of reasons. There's a lot of judgment that comes into play. Like, do you think when I launch this, I'm not going to be judged? I can guarantee you within 5 minutes of deploying this, somebody will create a forum thread explaining what they like and, more importantly to them, what they don't like. It's happened every single time, and I appreciate it, but also am offended by it every single time as well. Yes, obviously you appreciate somebody pointing out things that you missed. That's always greatly appreciated. But there will also be those who aren't interested in helping you or improving it. They're interested in taking you down or criticizing you or any of these things. And it happens not just with me, but every site I've seen of a similar nature. Or somebody writes a blog post and the Reddit thread completely trashes them. That's the world we live in. It'd be great if people focused more on, okay, good job, here's a couple of things I noticed, versus bring back the old design, or this sucks, or what were you thinking? I've seen it with Smashing Magazine, I've seen it with CSS Tricks, I've seen it with Envato. It's just kind of the nature of the game, especially when you have a site that is tailored to web developers and web designers who will use the site. They feel incredibly at liberty to voice their concerns, even if they weren't asked for. You know, it's like going to somebody's house and criticizing their decor. You know, you would never do that in real life, but online, for some reason, it's par for the course. And all you have to do is say, quote unquote, just saying, I'm just telling you what I think. You know, online it's okay, but in real life that would never even remotely be okay. If somebody criticized your home or your decor, the first thing you would say is get out of my house. So yeah, honestly, it's a very stressful thing to release this. Not to mention the worry that did something break. As much testing as you can possibly do, you almost always miss something. You know, all of your tests can return green and that's great, but what people never talk about is, does that mean everything works? No. It doesn't. It means everything you tested works, which is great, but what about the things that maybe you forgot to test, or you thought you were testing, but you actually weren't? This is very, very hard stuff, so big deployments like this always make me nervous. That being said, though, I was able to learn quite a bit. You know, I spend so much of my time doing backend work that sometimes I push these kind of refreshes to really focus on the front end to learn some new things. Like, for example, this gave me the opportunity to, you may have known this for years, but it gave me the opportunity to learn more about SVG. Obviously, I knew that you could use an image tag and reference a .svg icon or graphic, but honestly, that was kind of my extent of understanding. And naturally, I've always understood the value of it, but I've always thought the sales pitch was never good enough for developers. Like, developers are happy to do it. We can understand that it scales, that you're not going to get pixelation. But then the actual how-to, I've always felt was missing a little bit. You can read an article and they show you, but it was just always confusing. Like, what if I just want to use some SVG icons? Well, you're giving me all this SVG. Do I put that in an image tag? A lot of the tutorials will say, yeah, you can do that. So you do it, and then you realize, well, I can't easily change the color of this SVG icon now because it's in an image tag, and that means you can't change the fill property. So your options are basically, and I've researched all of this, so I'm very aware of it at this point. Your options are keep it in the image tag and then refer to lots of filters, like CSS filters to invert it or convert it to grayscale or things like that, so that if you want it gray, but when you hover over it, you want it the full color, you can use CSS filters. But if you want to get into actual color and your icon is only black to begin with, you can't really do it. If the icon is already red or something, again, you could use like a hue rotate filter. But it just doesn't work very well. So it turns out that you do want to use inline SVG. But again, that's kind of annoying as well. You know, you might come from using Bootstrap where you can just simply reference an icon font and it's as simple as it could possibly be. But you do learn that there are significant downsides to using an icon font. Everything from flickering to if you have certain ad blockers installed, it will just completely ruin the font. Like, I've had people, like the current version of Laracast, which if you're listening to this is the old version of Laracast, it uses an icon font. And if you do have an ad blocker or some ad blocker installed, you won't see the icon at all. And you'll submit a support request saying the site is broken, but it's related to that. There's all these nasty things you have to deal with. So what was I talking about? I'm rambling. I have a real weird tendency to ramble and ramble and ramble. And then I say, what was the question again? We were talking about SVG icon. Anyways, so you can inline the SVG. This is going to go way too long. Anyways, you can inline the SVG, but then that gets really gross. So that led me to thinking, well, maybe you can extract a partial, like if you're using Laravel or something, put it in a blade partial, and then you can just say include icons.gear or something like that. And then even as a second argument, you could pass through class names that you want and then just spit those out. But then that's gross too, because you're creating a blade partial for basically every icon you want to use. And the goal is to get to the point where you can just kind of rapidly go through this without always thinking, well, it would be nice to have a little calendar icon here. So I got to get the SVG. I'm going to create a partial. I'll put the partial in here. I'm going to set it up so that I can pass through a class and then I will include it. It's so slow. So what I ended up doing ultimately is I created a little blade directive that would do all this for me. So I have a blade directive where I type @icon, and then the name will be, of course, the file name of the icon SVG. And then the second argument would be any class names that I want added to the SVG element. So what happens then behind the scenes is it does a file get contents of the SVG file. It will cache it and then return it to you. So basically, it's a long-form way of keeping it simple to use while still having access to the SVG element itself, where you can then manipulate the fill and the stroke and all of that stuff. So that was one thing. It gave me an opportunity to really learn about SVG. Even outside of icons, I learned how to animate them, and you'll see cool stuff on the site related to that. Another interesting note In these last 3 months, I deleted the entire CSS folder and started from scratch. And I personally did not write float left once. I did not use the float property even once, which was kind of astounding because that is the bedrock. You know, for so many years, if you want to do anything, you're going to do float left. You're going to do float right. You're going to do that little trick where after those, you say clear both, to make sure you clear your floats. It's nasty stuff that we had to do, but I was able to use Flexbox for everything this time, which was really exciting. I'm such a dork. It's really exciting I could use Flexbox. It was, but the dark alley of all of this is that it's still somewhat young. Not to say that you can't use it. Browser support is actually really great. So unless you run a CNN type site where you have to support very, very old versions of a browser, you probably are going to be okay. But what I mean by dark alley is that, do you remember back in the IE7 and IE6 days where there were all these bugs? I talked about it the last episode. And you just had to know them to understand how to fix them because they made no sense. To some extent, that's where Flexbox is right now. You can use it, and in Chrome, it's very reliable, but you'll find in Firefox or Internet Explorer, just random things are different. Random default values do not line up with what is suggested in the spec. So it'll be great in Chrome, but then you'll go to Firefox, and it's not working. So for like Firefox with button elements, inline flex, that's a little weird. Or you'll find situations where with Firefox, the minimum width value is incorrectly set. And that can end up in situations where the width of a child element goes way too far. Like I had that with Laracast, where on a forum page, I realized that in Firefox alone, when the user would add a code snippet, so when I would have pre-tags, they would stretch way too wide. They would stretch outside the containing box. And I couldn't figure out why, because on Chrome and Safari, it was perfect. But on Firefox, it was doing this, and I could not for the life of me figure it out. You know, I did the thing where I opened up DevTools, and you just start turning properties on and off. Does this change it? Nope. This. Just trying to narrow it down to where the problem was. And I finally, after Googling for an hour, found one article where I learned that, again, with Firefox, the minimum width value is set improperly. So you have to go to the parent element, where the flex value is set, and you have to put minimum width or min-width equals zero, and miraculously that fixes everything in Firefox. There's all that kind of junk where you're going to hit a roadblock, you have to Google to figure out what the issue is, and for whatever reason, the inconsistency is always in Firefox, which is a rarity, but it is what it is. It's still worth it, though, to know that I don't have to worry about floats anymore and how brittle those can really be. What else? I did use a CSS framework. I used Bulma this time. I didn't use Twitter Bootstrap. You can go to, I don't even know what the website is, bulma.io. Really good. Once again, it's based on Flexbox, and I feel like it includes everything you'd want and nothing you don't want. So it's very precise. It even has this cool tiling setup that I used quite a bit on the series page. And you're going to see all these featured collections as you scroll the page. What you'll see is that dependent upon the number of items in the collection, the layout will be different. So you'll see kind of a cool tiled effect where this one has 7 and they're all lined up where you have one big item and then 3 smaller items on the right and then 4 mid-sized items on the bottom. You know, stuff like that. And the way I got that to be dynamic, again, is by using Bulma tiles. So what I did for that is I set up blade partials where I created the markup assuming specific numbers of items. This is the only way I could figure out how to do it. So like assuming you have 8 items in this collection, this is the way I want it to appear. Assuming you have 4 items, then I want it 2 up and then 2 below here. So I'd create the markup for all of those. And that way it can be very flexible and very dynamic. And all I have to do is dynamically figure out the number of items in the collection and then load the associated partial for that. And that's all I'd have to do. And then once you get to the max, like if there's more than 9 items in this collection, then just default to a slider, something like that, like a Netflix-style slider. And that way, everything ends up being pretty flexible, which is great. Anyways, what else? What other things did I work on? I did quite a bit of work related to billing. A lot of it's behind the scenes, but I did add, like I talked about maybe an episode or two ago, I added Apple Pay support and Alipay, which is like PayPal in China. Luckily, if you do all of that through Stripe, the APIs they provide are so good that you don't have to spend 2 weeks figuring out how to work with Apple Pay. I had both of those done in a day. It's just not that much work. And then lastly, let's do two more, then we'll call it a day. If you've watched the Monstrous Code series at Laracast, I do have one episode related to query objects. And this is something that I actually used two or three different times in the code base. I would have a situation where the query I need to run is pretty complicated. It needs to be cached, but also it's very dynamic dependent upon the user and what they've watched, what they're currently watching, what they've saved, all of that stuff. So keeping it in the controller felt weird. Just putting it in a repository as a method felt weird. So reaching for a query object, I think, was a very good way to go. A query object is, just think of it like this. You're just throwing it into its own class. So you create a class where the name corresponds to the query you're running. So how about this? We were just talking about fetching the featured series collections. That's a significant query. So I would call that featured collections query. And then I will have a get method where I basically paste in the full query I'm doing, and then I can organize it, extract methods, dynamically call methods dependent upon if you're signed in, if you have series that are currently in development, and I can build all of that stuff up. Then in your controller, all you have to do is new up the query object and call the get method. That's a nice and simple way to go. It's easy to test. I used that a number of times. And then finally, yeah, I'm going to close with this. The thing I've learned, the more and more I've worked as a developer, is that when it comes to refactoring, I'm never making it more complex. I'm always making it simpler. And this goes against a lot of the evangelism in the community and a lot of what we're taught. We're taught that things need to be complicated because these are complex domains and blah, blah, blah. And I feel like the people who say these things will forever miss the point that you want it as simple as humanly possible. And maybe the simplest you can get it is still unavoidably complex, but you're still pushing for the simplest version of that. So when it came to the refactors I did, it was never finding ways to make things more complicated. I found that almost every single time, I was reducing complexity. Or in other words, I was, for example, I was removing the interface. I wasn't adding a new one because I added the interface 2 years ago, but now I've had a lot of experience to show that interface didn't give me any value whatsoever, so it's gotta go. Those are the sorts of things I'm talking about. Every mistake I made 2 years ago when writing some of this code was fixed, again, not by making it more complicated, but by removing the complexity I added back then and replacing it with something far more easy and intuitive and direct. And on that note, this is specifically why just about every single developer will go through that phase where they go too far. It's almost like a drug where you think the more misdirection and abstraction you add, the better your code base is going to be. So you end up going way, way too far. And this can last for a number of years. You know, there's tons of comics that kind of make fun of this. The intermediate developer who has created this monstrosity of a code base because that's where all of your teaching has led you. But then most people do get to a point where you realize, holy crap, what have I done here? I need to not expand more, but start contracting. And you start removing complexity. You start removing unnecessary interfaces. You start removing the classes that end in quote-unquote ER, your classes. You start to realize, maybe that was just procedural code where I didn't know what to do. I didn't know a more object-oriented way to deal with it, so I'm just going to throw it in there. Every single developer has done that. Anyways, you start contracting more and more, and then I think as you grow as a developer, you get to a point, or you keep pushing toward a point where it's a lot more manageable and a lot more reasonable. You know, being a good developer in 2016, I think, means understanding that you have to be reasonable. And just because a book or a principle says that this particular code violates something doesn't mean it needs to change. It means you might consider changing it, but by all means, if you decide to keep it where it is, that is a perfectly okay thing. It takes a very, very long time to get to that point. Like I said, in your intermediate stage, the books and the principles and the patterns you learn, they're like mandates where you think, ooh, I don't want to break the law, so I have to do this. And this is where you hear others talking about principles and patterns all the time. Those are supposed to help you. They're not supposed to hurt you. But there's a stage where it almost feels like a noose around your neck, where you think, if I violate this, I'm in big trouble. Anyways, you got to get through that simply by doing it every single day, by the way. You got to get through that to the point where you understand, I recognize this pattern or this principle, and I understand what it means. And I also understand why I'm completely going to ignore it for this particular class or project. Anyways, that was a long, as always, rambling podcast. I'm looking forward to editing 20 minutes of my stupid voice. I hope you enjoy it. I hope I didn't bore you too much, and I will see you next time.